Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm your host, Michael Keegan, and our guest today is Julie Parity, Administrator of the Food and Nutrition Service within the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Also joining us today from IBM is Randy Livingston. Julie, in 2009, I understand that approximately 14% or 17 million households were food insecure. At the same time, we face an obesity epidemic among not only adults, but children as well. As unbelievable as it may seem, obesity and hunger do coexist. Would you explain this seemingly paradoxical reality, and what are the causes that have led to this situation?
Well, there's a lot that we still have to learn about that. But a number of studies have suggested a possible correlation between food insecurity and obesity. It may be because nutrient poor foods, energy dense foods, cost less. And so that sort of promotes an overconsumption of calories leading to weight gain. To maintain adequate energy intake, people who have to limit their food costs may select lower quality diets consisting of high energy and inexpensive foods. People eat fewer fruits and vegetables, we know, as food insecurity worsens. One of the interesting things that we've been talking about recently is there's increasing interest in developing materials and messages showing that fruits and vegetables need not be more expensive. There's so much interest in eating well and eating more fruits and vegetables. And I think the general assumption is that typically fruits and vegetables are more expensive and so more out of reach of low-income households. But if you shop carefully and you know what you're looking for, that's not necessarily the case. You really can feed your family well on a tight budget. But I don't think we've done a very good job of explaining that to people and giving people the tips and the clues that they need to be able to make that work. So that's going to be something that we need to look at as we move forward. It has been a concern for us in the SNAP program for many years. I remember when I was part of the Clinton administration, we actually did develop a small recipe booklet that could be distributed to households when they applied for the food stamp program that would show them how they can use low-cost but nutritious meals to provide food and a nutritious meal for their family. So this is something that is of great interest to us. I think there's a lot of work that needs to be done. I don't think that there's any question but what these two can be related. And I think it is a myth, for example, to suggest that people who are poor and overweight don't need help and don't need a food benefit, that they don't need the SNAP program. It's not because they're overeating. It's not because they have more money than they, you know, than they need to eat properly, but it's a function of the types of foods that are most easily accessible to them. You know, the other thing is we have been recently talking about this term food deserts, and we know that in many communities there is not easy access to a grocery store that has a wide range of foods, and so often people in low-income communities are restricted to going to a retailer that may not offer the most nutritious foods or wide range of nutritious foods, and it is something that we call a food desert. And so we're working with the Department of Treasury, with other sister agencies at USDA on something called the Healthier Food Financing Initiative to be able to provide grants to get at this issue of food deserts. So it's a complicated issue. I think it's one that's been oversimplified over time. It's one we're very concerned about, and I think we still have a lot more to learn about it.
Julie, with over a $90 billion budget, it's critical, clearly critical, for FNS to be a strong fiscal steward of the public trust. This requires ensuring payments are correct and those who are eligible for the benefits receive the proper amounts. Would you elaborate on your efforts to eliminate improper payments and work with states to improve overall program performance and integrity, as well as how technology factors into your efforts?
Well, we have been about this for a very, very long time. I think we have really quite an extraordinary record in this regard. One of the problems, of course, is that the improper payments in our programs, our biggest programs, of course, SNAP and the School Meals Program, because they reach so many people, we reach 32 million people for kids, for example, in the School Meals Program. I mentioned we reach almost 43 million people with the SNAP program. So even if our errors are proportionally very, very small, they still add up to big numbers. And so we continue to be a primary focus when it comes to making sure that taxpayer dollars are spent properly and wisely. We take it very, very, very seriously. In SNAP, we have had from the inception of the program a very robust quality control system that measures errors that are made by either applicants to the program or by the caseworkers in the states that are administering the program. We provide performance bonuses to states. I mean, in the old days, we used to just have sanctions, and then we realized that it would be helpful to have a carrot as well. And so the Congress has authorized us to provide on an annual basis performance bonuses to states with the best and the most improved payment accuracy. And these are in the millions of dollars, and states vie for these performance bonuses. We do still have a system that could impose penalties on states with the poorest payment accuracy performance. And every year we've got some states we have to work with that need to improve their performance. We've put together something called the National Payment Accuracy Work Group. It's a team of experts from our agency, both the national and regional offices, to monitor and evaluate the progress in payment accuracy in SNAP and exchange information on best practices with the states. And we talk about technology with them and how we might be able to help them get more efficient in terms of their business processes. We have an early detection system based on preliminary quality control data so that we can quickly get in. If it looks like a state's going to have, you know, problems, we can get in before the year is out and see if we can't help them correct those so that they won't be in a sanction mode. So we have actually gotten to be very, very skillful in terms of trying to find those errors that are made in our programs.
So, Julie, how do your programs and resources support the nation's emergency feeding networks, such as food banks and soup kitchens? And more particularly, what is being done to improve and expand their capacity?
Well, I'm glad you asked that, particularly given that I had 5 years working at America's Second Harvest, now called Feeding America, the nation's food bank network. It's a series of about 200 food banks around the country. As you probably know, they get food not only from USDA, but they also get private donations and private funding, and we give them some administrative funding as well. The USDA part of that is something called the Emergency Food Assistance Program, something we affectionately call TFAP, and that's a statutory program that provides some funding for us to buy foods and also provides funding that we can help the food bank community meet their administrative costs. Funds actually go out through the states and the commodities, but most state distributing agencies now use the food bank community to distribute those funds. One of the wonderful things about the food bank community is that they really do understand their role in the nutrition safety net. They understand that school meals and SNAP are the primary pieces of this nutrition safety net, the other domestic nutrition assistance feeding programs, WIC, and that their role really is to sort of fill in the gaps wherever that safety net is a little bit frayed. They can be there to help families out. And so because they have come to realize their role, they are terrific and powerful and compelling advocates for our programs. And I know when I worked in the Congress, members were always so impressed when they would be visited by a food stamp director saying, "We need to make the food stamp program stronger because my food bank cannot take care of all of the folks in your district that have a problem and are having trouble putting food on their family table." And I've been doing this work for 30 years, and it's really been quite amazing to see how this nutrition community has grown, has evolved, has gotten much more sophisticated and much more powerful. And I think largely because of the commitment of this food bank network to all of our programs. And I really think it's one of the reasons that our programs enjoy the popularity that they do across the nation and in the Congress. And it hasn't always been so. Our connection with the food bank community is strong. It's compelling. And we couldn't do our work without them.
The 2008 Farm Bill authorized $20 million to research whether incentives for participants in the SNAP program will increase their purchase of healthy foods. Would you tell us more about the Healthy Incentives Pilot, HIP? How do you intend to evaluate its success, and in what practical ways does the HIP pilot represent an innovative approach to getting Americans to eat better?
This is an incentives-based program. What it's going to actually do is we're going to enroll about 7,500 randomly selected SNAP households to receive these incentives. For every dollar that a participant spends on fruits and vegetables using their SNAP EBT card, their debit card, 30 cents will be added to their benefit balance, thus cutting the cost of fruits and vegetables by almost one-third. So this should provide an additional incentive for them to purchase fruits and vegetables. And we are very, very excited to see what we'll learn from this project. We've got a very robust evaluation planned. It is not cheap. We're going to spend $20 million to see if this can really make a difference in terms of changing the purchasing habits of people who are participating in SNAP.
Your FNS programs are designed to provide access to healthy food and also build the skills and motivation to support and encourage healthy lifestyles. Would you elaborate on other efforts in health promotion, education, and economic development? And what are some of the key ways FNS is making nutrition education more effective?
Yeah, education is really, nutrition education is so important. It's fundamental to all of our programs. I think one of the reasons that the programs enjoy the support they do is because all of them have some nutrition education component to them. So we really do care not just making sure that people are eating, but that they are eating well. I just came before this broadcast from a meeting of nutrition education experts in the area of our SNAP program. We are reevaluating how we're doing what we call SNAP Ed. SNAP Ed is SNAP Nutrition Education. And we're reevaluating how we're doing that and want to make sure that it's as robust as it possibly can be. We're learning so much in terms of nutrition education and what is effective nutrition education. We are pushed on a regular basis by OMB, by people on the Hill, particularly at this time of really tight budgets, to make sure that all of the nutrition education dollars that are being spent by USDA are being spent wisely. So we're being asked questions about which of the programs that you do are most effective, which are not. And that data is very, very hard to come by, particularly if what you care about is changing actually the consumption patterns of people. We don't want to measure these just by how many classes have we held or how many brochures have we passed out. What we really want to know is, are those people, are those households actually eating better, eating more nutritious food as a result of our nutrition education interventions? And that kind of data is very, very difficult to come by, but it's increasingly necessary. And I think the nutrition education community really does understand the importance of it. So this is an ongoing concern of ours. It's an ongoing effort. I think we still have a lot to learn, but the potential is absolutely enormous.
Judy, I was impressed as I was preparing for this conversation about the role your agency plays in emergency response. Perhaps you can elaborate on some of the benefits or services you provide during a disaster relief, and how do you do it?
You know, we've learned a lot over the years. We actually do have a program we call DSNAP. It's our disaster SNAP program. And in communities that have been struck by a devastating flood or a devastating hurricane, it certainly came into play, for example, in Katrina. You may remember the earthquake in Northern California some numbers of years ago, the floods through North Carolina back in the early days of 1999-2000. So we have really developed a program for SNAP. And so if you are a SNAP household that's lost all your food, you can get replacement benefits under DSNAP. If you're a low-income family that maybe wasn't participating in SNAP, you lost all your food, you can get DSNAP benefits. And these are benefits that give you the opportunity to go to a grocery store and replace the food that was lost as a result of the disaster. We also, of course, have got USDA foods, what we formerly used to call commodities. We're now calling it USDA foods. And those are available to state and local and voluntary organizations for shelters and other mass feeding sites, or sometimes in food packages that are distributed directly to households in need. You may remember during Katrina, you would see those tables that would be set up with food for people. That is largely USDA foods. We can actually move foods out of school warehouses in time of a disaster and use them so that we can get food on the ground very quickly, and then we can later come in and replace those foods that might be in school warehouses. So we've got a pretty sophisticated way of meeting the food needs of people following a disaster.
What does the future hold for the USDA's Food and Nutrition Service? We will ask its administrator, Julie Parity, when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour.